Before we begin, just giving you an update on our new subscription. It's called David McWilliams Plus on Apple. You just double click, you get no ads, and you get me and John, pure and simple.
And Mac, you get early access episodes. Did you know that?
Sure, my day is made.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you? It is podcast time. Do you remember the drill? The podcast that makes economics comprehensible, understandable, and hopefully a little bit more relevant to everybody's life. Now, we haven't said that for a long, long time. I hope you are coming to terms at the end of the summer. You've had a good time. Life has treated you well. You haven't been drowned in the various biblical deluges that have afflicted Ireland over the last couple of weeks. And John, how are you?
I'm good. I'm still on the mend. Not quite 100% yet, but almost there.
So the Ned is still... You're on a new diet, I presume.
I had to move from literally a baby food diet, no fiber whatsoever, to a full-on fiber diet now. So we're rocking away.
Anyway, let us move on. Today, I want to talk to you about overvalued and undervalued exchange rates, John.
Yes.
Crucial part of monetary economics that is often forgotten because so much of the world, at least our world, is on fixed exchange rates or have given away their exchange rate or have locked in their exchange rate at various different levels. But the impact of over and undervalued exchange rate is profound. It's the reason we have monetary policy. Basically, economics, macroeconomics, is about two things. Imagine a boxer fighting with two arms. Yep. One arm is monetary policy. One arm is fiscal policy, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you tie your currency, and I'm going to talk about this in a second. I was contemplating this, John, as I was in Pula the other day in northern Croatia.
But right.
If you tie your currency, like you join the euro, for example, at too high a level, your country, your economy will suffer profoundly from a lack of competitiveness. And over time, this will manifest itself in a bond crisis, okay? We'll park that.
Okay.
If, on the other hand, you tie your currency and your economy proves to be very successful, like Ireland, over time, that undervalued exchange rate, which I believe we have, will manifest itself in asset price bubbles, far too much investment, arguably too much immigration, and too much overheating. Croatia, where I am, I believe is going to have an overvalued exchange rate when they join the euro next year. And that will lead to long-term structural problems here. Whereas Ireland now has an undervalued exchange rate, and our long-term structural problems are problems not of money, but of capacity.
Actually, you need to explain all this and explain why Croatia are going to join the euro if they're not ready for it, and what are the implications of being undervalued exchange rate for us. But before we get there, what's all this about Pula? And what sparked off all these musings, Mac?
Well, it's because I was last night or the night before, John, I was reclining in a bar beside a statue of James Joyce.
Right. Okay.
Okay. And the statue
reclining in a bar is nothing new.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Well, the reason I was reclining is the statue of James Joyce has him sitting down in Pula, a city in Istria, northern Croatia, which used to be an Italian city before the Second World War.
Right.
After the Second World War, the Italian population was largely driven out by the Yugoslav partisans, not least because the Italian population in this part of the world was displaying a type of proximity to fascism, which the local Yugoslavs did not appreciate. Lots of nasty things were done in the Second World War in this neck of the woods. And basically, the Yugoslav partisans rushed through this part of the world, took over Istria, and they weren't giving it back to the Italians. But
right.
Before the war, our friend James Joyce was here.
Okay.
And James Joyce arrives in 1905 to Trieste, where he's promised a job in the Berlitz, you know, that international school, English teaching school, Berlitz.
And they used to have those Berlitz books, you know, the Precisely. Travel books.
Exactly. The same company. And that started its life as an English language school. And it moved into the travel because it realized that most of the people that they were trying to learn foreign languages were just travelers, casual travelers. So that's what moved into that area. Joyce is working for Berlitz. He's supposed to get a job in Trieste, which is about 100 miles away up the road. The job never materializes. So he's arrived in 1905 with a pregnant Nora. So his missus is pregnant. He's got no money. Somebody tells him there's a job down the road in Pula, which is a city about 100 miles south, a much less impressive city than Trieste, much smaller, was an Austrian-Hungarian naval base at the time. So right. Joyce thought it was a little bit of a dull place. He didn't particularly like the local Slavs because there was lots and lots of Slovenes and Croats here at the time. It was run by the Austrian-Hungarians, but deep down it was still an Italian-speaking city, bizarrely cosmopolitan place. Joyce didn't particularly like it, but did quite like the cafes. So,
well, and he writes, anyway.
Yeah, he writes that he quite liked the cosmopolitan cafes and all that sort of stuff. And this is where a 24-year-old Joyce is beginning to try and get the Dubliners published, what he'd actually already written. And that becomes a lifelong, well, the next decade's work for Joyce is to try and get Dubliners published. Which took him about a decade to do. Then he gets The Portrait of an Artist published, he gets Dubliners published, and he's away in a hack.
Yeah.
But I'm sitting here in the same bar, and the reason he's in the bar, because the bar is in the basement of the, or not in the basement, the first ground floor of the school that he used to teach in. And what I'm looking at, John.
The school, a bar and a school.
No, the school, the building. It's the building where the school used to be.
I just want to be clear about that.
It's the building where the school used to be. But what I'm looking at, John, is this extraordinary Roman arch. It's a huge Roman arch. I'm here because last night I saw the Arctic Monkeys, John,
nice.
In a Roman amphitheater.
How
and
were they?
They were supported by Inhaler, who are friends of Lucy's.
Yes, and great band.
It was their fantastic band. They did an amazing job, you know, because as you know, support band is hard.
Yeah.
Because the audience has come to see somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit of a wild card. You don't know what you're going to get when you walk on stage.
And they were brilliant. They were brilliant. They opened it up. They have a couple of banging tunes. They did what they had to do,
which is
to go out, win the audience, get the audience listening to them. And I presume as the thing is about all supporting is you're trying to convert a bigger band's fan base to you.
Yeah.
And then people go away and say, wow, you know, they were quite good at the support act. Why, who are they?
Yeah. So sell a few t-shirts on the way.
So they did a fantastic job. An amazing amphitheater. It's the Pula Amphitheater, which is the best preserved Roman amphitheater in the world. And the Croats have opened it up to gigs. So you're actually sitting in...
What does it sound like?
It sounds like you're sitting, well, I don't know what it sounded like in the Colosseum, right? But imagine you're in the Colosseum, right?
Yeah.
Now, of course, the sound is bouncing off all the walls.
That's what I was thinking.
It sounded brilliant. It felt brilliant. The Arctic Monkeys came on and they gave a masterclass, an absolute masterclass. You know, Alex Turner is the front man. He just has it. He's got the swagger. He's got the cockiness. He's got the voice. He's got the attitude. And they just they played banger after banger. It was an extraordinary gig. And they played for about 2 hours.
Fantastic. And of course, they're supporting us down in Electric Picnic.
They are supporting us down in Electric Picnic next week. And as I said to them on the way in, I said, listen, lads, I know you're going to be overwhelmed by the extraordinary vibe in our tent, but, you know, just try to recreate that in the main stage and you'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were really, really very good. You forget their back catalogue is so good. He can write songs. You know, he just has it. Yeah. So it was an extraordinary gig. So then now I am reclining after this, the day after.
Of course.
And I'm looking at this arch because the Romans, the way the Romans planned their cities, well, they'd have everything was related to the amphitheater. So the amphitheater was in the center. And then you'd have coming off at these sort of, almost sort of big, big streets leading into the amphitheater, kind of funneling people down into the amphitheater. And at the entrance of this street is the original Roman arch that I'm looking at. It was called the Arch of Sergi. It was built around the time of Jesus. And there's an amazing, I'm just looking at this thing, there's an amazing inscription. And the inscription says, Salvia postuma Sergi de sua pecunia, right? Which means this arch was built by the wife of Sergi, whose name was Salvia. This is the interesting thing, de sua pecunia with her own money, right?
Right.
So this got me thinking about Roman money.
Yeah.
And in the same way as the European Union has solidified integration through a single currency, the Romans gave us the model, right? So the Romans had this money called the denarii. That was their base currency, where the Spanish expressions dinero comes from. You know, the Spanish say, you know, have you any dinero? That comes from denarii, which was the Roman silver coin, which formed the basis of the Roman Monetary Union. And we forget that the Roman Monetary Union extended, think about this, from the southern borders of Scotland to the western borders of Syria.
Yes. Yeah.
From the western borders of the Rhine all the way down to North Africa. So in this entire empire, of course, the army kept the whole thing together, right? But what actually gelled people's perceptions of day-to-day transactions of who they were was this unified single currency. And what made Rome fantastically interesting is the Romans could never feed themselves. The city of Rome produced nothing. Mm. Like the city of Athens, neither of these cities could feed themselves. So what they were actually in the business of was persuading people to exchange grain for their coin.
Right.
And in so doing, willingly trying to feed themselves. It's an extraordinary situation.
But also, they were their administrative center, though.
So Rome was the capital, and then they had all these nodes of administrations around it. But they built what can only be described as an empire of credit. It was an extremely sophisticated credit system. They had stock markets, they had joint stock companies, they had bond markets, they had banks, they had mortgages, they had everything. And it kind of struck me, I was wondering about Salvia, who's the wife of Sergi, who made the arch with her own money. And I'm trying to figure out how she did that. Like, how did a woman in an incredibly patriarchal system figure out how to make enough money of her own in order to build the arch? I haven't got to that conclusion yet. I have no idea.
Right.
But that intrigued me. And what also intrigued me, John, was the nature of monetary unions. How do they stay together? Are there problems there? And the reason I'm thinking about this is that Croatia, the country that, as you know, I spend a huge amount of time in, love, really like the people, they're joining the euro in January at a very, very high exchange rate, which is 7.7 kunas to the euro. And I'm not sure that this country can sustain that high level of exchange rate.
Now, Mark, there's a load of stuff in this that I need you to explain, but let's come back and talk about that after this.
Absolutely.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
So, Mark, you're saying that Croatia are joining the Eurozone from January. Are they the only ones joining this year? And also, what does that mean for the Euro? Is it going to weaken it in any sort of way? Or explain that one to me.
Well, a very interesting question, John. I think the Croats are joining in January. They're the only ones joining at this stage. But now implicit in all European treaties is the objective that anybody who joins the European Union is on the path towards joining the euro. It's part of the package. Now, Denmark and Sweden have opted out of that. They opted out of it both by referenda in the late 90s, early 2000s, because the Scandinavians have always had a slightly semi-detached attitude to European integration in terms of monetary integration. They've always said, look, we'll keep our currency. We'll go along with everything else. We'll keep our currency just in case, right? Because the currency... Your currency is the most important price in the economy. It's by far and away, if you're a small open economy, your currency prices everything because it prices your imports and your exports. And that's basically how you live and die in a small open economy. And with the exception of Germany and Italy and France, you can almost argue the rest of Europe are all small open economies. Maybe Spain, you could argue, is a big economy. But in general, the European Union is made up of small open economies. That's the first thing. So there's a sort of a legal obligation to move towards joining the euro. Okay, and I can understand why. The reason is that it solidifies the club from the central point of view, but also from the peripheral countries that want to join the euro. There's kind of a notch on the bedpost sort of idea of join the euros. That's what you have to do, right? That kind of marks up your virility as an economy, okay? Right?
Okay.
Now, I also think that there's a huge implicit danger in this. And the implicit danger is that certain countries that have had hyperinflation or have experienced lots of economic trauma, Croatia being one of them after the Yugoslav hyperinflation, Yugoslavia had the highest hyperinflation ever recorded, higher than Weimar Germany.
Right.
So this part of the world was destroyed by hyperinflation in the 80s and then again in the 90s. So,
the Croats. How did that happen?
Well, in the 80s, it was basically they began to print money. After Tito died in 1980, there was a series of conflicts within the various republics.
Yeah.
And the Bank of Yugoslavia just continued to print money willy nilly. And of course, what happened was Yugoslavia wasn't capable of producing goods commensurate with the amount of money that was being printed. So, you got hyperinflation, right?
Okay. Gotcha.
Typically what happens is if you can produce goods commensurate with the amount of money you're printing, then it means that you probably won't experience inflation even if you're printing all the time. But the Yugoslavs printed all the time and they just ended up in a hyperinflationary spiral. And then in the 1990s, Milosevic printed loads of money to finance the wars in Bosnia and Croatia, etc. So they had two bouts of hyperinflation. The Croats have a keen memory for that, and I've always wanted to avoid that. That's number one. Number two, joining the euro is kind of like another accolade in the process of becoming a proper European country. At least they feel this way. So in order to get away from their Yugoslav stroke Balkan past, joining the Euro is, you know, you're joining the rich man's club.
Yeah.
But if you join the rich man's club and you're a poor man, you have a problem. As the great expression is, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
The problem is you could be at the table, but you're still on the menu in the sense that if your economy is too weak.
Hang on a second. How do you gauge a weak economy or a strong economy?
Well, the first one is income per head.
Okay.
So if you're miles away from the average, well, then you're pretty weak. Second one is your budget deficit. If you're continuing to run a budget deficit, it means you can't balance your books.
Yeah.
So you're borrowing all the time.
Right. Okay.
Third one is your trade deficit. If you are running a massive trade deficit, it means that your economy isn't producing. So your imports are much, much greater than your exports, right? Then you have to attract in capital from elsewhere to cover your costs. So you're running a current account deficit.
Yeah.
It means that you're borrowing consistently. And that will mean that your debt GDP ratio is rising all the time, right? So these are your particular metrics, okay?
So why are they joining then? If this ain't going to work.
Now, let's come back, right? And of course, the other really fundamental metric is, are you experiencing immigration or emigration?
Yeah.
A country experiencing emigration means that its own people are moving away.
The brain drain.
A country experiencing immigration means that other people are coming to you. So that's a great acid test of economic success, right? Now, what happens is, if you price your exchange rate too high, for economic virility ideas, but also maybe because a huge amount of the economy has got debts in foreign currency. And if you devalue, those debts will double, or those debts will go up by the level of devaluation. So you're worried about that. You're kind of caught in a trap. However, I would argue that it is better to devalue your currency and then fix to the euro and achieve a competitive gain against the rest of the world in order to reverse all those imbalances like your budget deficit, your current account deficit, your immigration, to give your economy the chance to grow.
So why don't they do that then?
Because I think that, remember I talked about the good room, right?
Yes.
Remember the good room, right?
Yeah.
My granny had a good room, which was there to impress the good people, the posh people.
Yeah.
My granny's good room was so good, I wasn't good enough to go into it,
yeah.
Right?
We had one of those as well. It was full of, we had a cabinet full of silver and Waterford crystal. I had no idea what they were there
for. You ever used it? I'll tell you, my granny had a bragging wall in the good room, right? And the bragging wall had all these sort of, you know, university parchments and things.
Yeah.
And there was one, I swear to Jesus, right? There was one in my granny's thing. There was a fella in one of those mortarboard hats, right?
Yeah.
With a university thing, the black and white photos from the 20s. Nobody has a rash as who he was. We think granny bought it in the sale of work and just put it up and pretended. So imagine that sort of mentality, right? Imagine that sort of mentality, okay? That basically you want to be with the big boys. You want to be in the good room. And you take that as your fundamental starting point on countries that are slightly insecure about themselves, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, rather than saying to the ECB and the Council of Europe, look, guys, we want to join the euro, but look, our economy isn't strong enough for this rate. What they do is they assume away, they think everything's going to be fine. Now, you join the euro and then you're done, then you're in. But
yeah.
You can't get out, or you can get out. But if you do get out, unless you get out at a time when the rest of the euro is collapsing, and you basically say, well, look, we've no choice. If
yeah.
you get out in your own accord, then of course it has huge ramifications for people's perceptions of you. Now, interestingly, in 2012, when the euro looked as if it was going to collapse, right, because there was an Italian crisis, a Greek crisis, a Spanish crisis,
yeah.
our interest rates were at 13%. I always argued, look, if this thing collapses, right, from this inside out, well,
yeah.
then that's okay. Well, let's figure it out a way. Why? Because Ireland had a current account surplus. We were moving into a situation where the economy was recovering. The situation was entirely different. So you can actually do it. But the question is, for a small country, you shouldn't be taking unilateral moves. But if it happens, you've got to figure things out because,
sure.
in effect, shit happens. And you've got to be ready for that. But to come back to the Croats. So the Croats, like the Greeks before them and the Italians now, are suffering or will suffer, I believe, under this very, very high exchange rate. and the economy will be strangulated simply because it's so hard to compete with everybody else. And what will happen in a country like Croatia is they'll say, okay, we won't compete in an industrial scale, but we always have tourism.
Right.
But the problem is that nobody ever gets rich on tourism because tourism is a low productivity, high labor intensive activity, number one. And number two, it's seasonal. So it's only four months of the year or 6 months maximum, right? So it's always a nice add-on, tourism, but it can never be the engine of growth. And I think what basically happens is if you fix too high, your industrial side of your economy is too unproductive vis-a-vis Germany.
Yeah.
So what you do is you overburden your entire growth rate on things like tourism and like natural resources. And ultimately, they're not sufficient to keep you going every year. So that means, therefore, that you run current account deficits, you have high levels of emigration, and you have intermittent bond crises where the market says, hold on a second, these guys will not be able to pay their debts. And this is what's happened in Greece and in Italy and whatever. Now, the ECB will come up with various little jiggery-pokery ways of militating against bond crisis by buying bonds, etc. But the underlying problem remains the overvalued exchange rate. Now, that's the Croatian thing. Let's look at Ireland, because Ireland's in an opposite situation, right? So if you look at the Irish economy, what you have is overheating.
Yeah.
House prices going through the roof.
Yeah.
Asset prices going up.
Yeah.
Significant levels of immigration, people coming in.
Yeah.
Huge, huge inward investment.
Yeah.
All of this hitting an economy that only has a certain capacity. Right.
Okay.
So Ireland is characterized by bottlenecks everywhere, bottlenecks in transport, bottlenecks in public infrastructure, bottlenecks in housing, right? All the problems Ireland has are problems of capacity. When we were young, Ireland's problem was always problems of money. We didn't have enough money to do the things we wanted to do. Now Ireland is awash with money. And what's actually holding us back is we don't have the physical capacity to do it.
So you're saying that Ireland's exchange rate, even though we're a euro, is kind of undervalued.
Completely.
But what does that mean? How do you measure that?
So if we had our own exchange rate, right?
Yeah.
What would happen when the economy starts to grow very, very quickly? So like we've been growing 5-7%.
Mm.
Even on the most conservative basis for ages, right? What would happen then is the local central bank would increase interest rates, increase real interest rates.
Right.
Irish interest rates now are -8%. Okay.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So it's everything is designed to flood capital into the country, right? And therefore, everything is now designed to squeeze the housing market, and everything is designed to elbow out the young people from the housing market by pushing up housing prices. Traffic is another great example.
Right? Yeah, housing is particularly important.
It's particularly opposite. Okay.
Yeah.
So what would happen in the case that you had your own exchange rate? Like just say, hypothetically, you had. The central bank would raise interest rates, would bear down on, by raising the cost of borrowing, would bear down on borrowing, would take the steam out of the domestic economy. That raising interest rates would also raise your exchange rate. Let's say we had the punt. The punt would rise very, very rapidly. A rapidly rising punt would mean that Ireland is very expensive. So all that capital that's flowing into multinational investment would actually begin to have a second thought about going into a country like Ireland. Mm. And that would, in a country like Ireland, which we've been obsessed by bringing levels of unemployment down because we've the trauma of the 80s. But right now, we probably have to figure out what's the right level of employment? What's the right level of capacity? Can we continue on driving the engine in second gear, but in full throttle, which is exactly what we're doing?
Right.
Or does somebody need to actually put on the brakes and say, hold on a second? But the problem is, without monetary policy, you can't put on the brakes.
So this is the fundamental problem of being part of the Eurozone.
It's the fundamental opportunity and the fundamental problem. So the opportunity is...
What kind of tools can the European Central Bank use? I mean, and is there an argument for some sort of... I know this goes against the whole idea of the euro, but some sort of two-tiered system?
Well, a dual exchange rate? Yeah, I mean, I think that... There's so much political capital invested in the euro now, it's very, very hard to change. It's a bit like when J.K. Galbraith said, when the conventional man is faced with the choice between changing his mind and finding the proof not to do so, he always gets busy looking for the proof.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, yeah, so that's the idea that the people who run the show are so invested in it. But what we're seeing is that what happens is, in the same way as the Croats could be condemned to years of underperformance, we could be condemned to years of outperformance and capacity constraints, because the exchange rate can't adjust upwards and downwards. All this stuff is based on a thing called Mundell and Fleming, were two Canadian economists who did a lot of this exchange rate work in the 1960s, right? Now, in the United States, you have, and this is the missing pin, the ECB can't do anything, but in the United States, if Boston is overheating,
yeah,
and let's say Alabama is underperforming, taxes from are raised in Boston, federal taxes.
Yeah.
They get put into the federal system and then they're spent in Alabama. And that acts as the what they call the automatic stabilizer, right? So right. The American Monetary Union or the Canadian Monetary Union or the Australian Monetary Union, between various provinces and territories and states, works because at the core is a federal fiscal system, a federal taxation system, which acts to take the steam out of the overheating area and inject vibrancy into the underperforming area.
Right.
And that's why America works. Europe doesn't have yet a federal fiscal system. So there's nothing to take the steam out of Ireland, and there's no central fund to inject vibrancy into Croatia or Greece or Italy or Spain or whatever country, not to mention Romania and Bulgaria and all these other countries that are going to join in time.
But is this what, I mean, we spoke about this before, about how Macron wanted to bring Europe closer together on monetary and fiscal policy. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Well, this is at the core. Now, the problem with fiscal federalism,
yeah,
is you really give away sovereignty, right?
Right.
And the European Union, at a time when nationalism is emerging in Europe,
yes, yeah,
are loath to try and push the envelope, as the Americans would say, to suggest, you know what we should do? We should have a federal centralized budget.
Yeah.
Because that will basically cause populism, nationalism to explode everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, because people will say, no, enough. Already, this is the problem. We see it in Germany. We see it in Italy. We'd see it in Ireland too. Irish people say, hold on a second, I'm not so sure about this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, because people, you can feel that growing, actually.
Yeah. Because people like their sovereignty. They're like, you know, I mean, so my sense is that, you know, these conversations you will not have, or you will not have in many European areas, because they don't want to admit the elephant in the room, whereas there is a dilemma at the core of the system.
Well, this will come to a head at some stage, surely.
It probably will. So at the moment, the ECB are trying to massage the entire thing. So for example, at the moment, if left to its own devices, the Italian bond market would be very, very weak. But the ECB is buying bonds from the Italian government, right? Which it said it would never do. So it's basically figuring out what I would say, little bits of financial jiggery-pokery to try and smooth everything over. But at the heart, and this is a dilemma, just really, again, I've always thought about it, but it comes to me when I'm in a country like Croatia, when I think, yeah, I understand why you're doing this for loads of geopolitical reasons, but are you ready yet? And then I look at a country like Ireland and say, look, the obvious elephant in the room is that we could cool this place down with much higher interest rates and a much higher exchange rate, but we have no sovereignty there because we've no monetary policy. Do you remember I said the boxer with the two hands, right?
Yes.
Imagine we're a boxer, but one hand is tied behind our back. We have no exchange rate, no monetary policy, no interest rate.
Yeah.
So we're doing all the fighting with just one fist. And that, I think, is what's happened. And if you look at, and let's go back now to the Romans, if you look at the history of monetary union in
love going back to Rome, the Romans.
Well, for us, the year 33 AD is the year in which Christ died.
Yeah.
That's what we look at. For the Romans, it was the year in which they had their first major credit, international credit crisis, right? Where the entire financial system imploded, which is why I was wondering whether Salvia the wife of Sergei, actually survived the first credit crisis.
Right. But yeah.
Think about it, if you're swanning around building arches, right? It's a bit like going to Barbados on your holidays. Okay. you're the big cheese. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're building cocktails in hand. You're building umbrellas. Trophy assets. You're building trophies all around the place, right? You're basically somebody who's got rich quick and is showing all your mates, I'm the fucking boss. Okay.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, did she survive the 30-33 AD Typerian credit crisis, right? But my point is that always in monetary unions, there are credit crises because there's different economic realities throughout the union. If you don't have centralized fiscal system as the Canadians, the Americans, the Australians have, you're open to the potential crisis. And as always, I suspect we should go back to history, learn the lessons, listen to the past. And the next time, John, you're walking under a triumphal arch in Pula.
Indeed.
Consider the verities and the practicalities of the monetary union.
Now, just before you go, last week, Lucy McWilliams with the Golden Voice released her new track called Break My Own Heart. It went down so well because it's such a banger of a tune, we're going to play it again. So here's Lucy McWilliams, Break My Own Heart.
You're never here when I'm with you, but I'll be here if you want me to. And just like smoke, I don't know where you go. I'm trying to know the part of you that you don't know yourself. Maybe I'm scared if I see inside, I'll go and look for someone else. And I don't understand, but I'll take your hand and try to feel how you felt. Taking a drag, I get a glance, I realize that I can help. Some people love, some people fight. Whatever gets you through the night, just keep your
of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.